to the Daily Gold Podcast. Covering precious metals, the junior mining sector, and global capital markets for intelligent investors. Now, here is your host, Jordan Roybern.
Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of the Daily Gold Podcast. With me today, returning guest, he is Rick Rule, and I'm sure all the listeners out there know Rick. They know who he is. But for those of you who don't, Rick Rule has been involved in the natural resource world, the natural resource finance world, for almost a half century. Is that right, Rick?
Sadly, that's right. I don't mean sadly in terms of the fact that I don't like lacking experience. I just don't like being old enough to be described as doing half a century's worth of anything.
But the point is, I mean, you know more than, or you've forgotten more than most people actually know. And my first question for you today, and I've heard you mention this a few times in other interviews, and so we have the Fed Day today, and everyone is so obsessed. Like, what are they going to say? How's the fate of the world is in their hands. That's so to speak. That's the reactions and the obsession with it. They seem to lead to that point. But in reality, someone like yourself, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you're so much more focused on, I would say, the micro than the macro with respect to actually researching companies, doing company analysis, and that sort of thing. I mean, I know you have your macro views, but can you explain why it's so much more important to, at least for retail investors out there, to focus on, researching companies, researching management, researching their projects? Why that's more important than trying to predict what the Fed is going to say or do, or how the market's going to react?
Jordan, one of the things I do is I grade individual portfolios. 80,000 of them have now been submitted to me. And studying 80,000 portfolios has taught me an awful lot about what investors and speculators do right and wrong. The most important thing that they do wrong is they don't understand very much about what they're investing in. To begin with, many people have many more companies in their portfolios than they could possibly understand. How can you make a good investment if you don't understand something? The second thing is that many people have a misconception about the company. As an example, somebody invests in a junior gold exploration stock, and they look for justification owning the stock by saying, Rick, if the gold price goes up, what will this do to the affairs of XYZ exploration company? And I try to explain to them that XYZ doesn't have any gold. They're only looking for gold. And if the price of something that you don't have any of goes up, it doesn't have a fundamental relationship with your value. It may have something to do with the narrative, which goes to say if your real business is hoodwinking morons that you're actually in the gold business, then it's of value to you. But from an investor's point of view, understanding what's actually important in an investment is the key to success. So while the gold price is important, understanding the companies that will actually benefit relative to their competitors in an increasing gold price environment is much more important than understanding the minutiae of the Fed actions day to day with regard to the gold point. The second point that you raised, perhaps unintentionally, is that too many people have too limited a time focus. They believe that they need to make money on their investments by the next long weekend. But that's not how money's made. It's ironic that as I've been on Earth a long time and I have less time left on Earth, my patience has grown. It isn't because I don't want immediate gratification. It's because I understand that what my wants are is irrelevant. Time or money, pardon me, is made through compounding, and compounding takes time. Investors whose actions are predicated on the action of the Fed, which they can't possibly anticipate, and where their time duration is limited to a week or a month or even a year, are people who are doomed to failure. People who understand enough about the dynamics, the competitive dynamics of the companies relative to their competitors and relative to the markets, are the people that succeed. Now, showing up daily at podcasts like the Daily Gold is very helpful. People who invest in their own education before they invest in their portfolio are the people who inevitably have a higher probability of being winners.
Yeah, well, thank you for that free plug, but you know, one thing I want to say, you know, supporting your view, which is interesting to me, and you know, these macro podcasts are great, and we talk about macro issues, and yes, I'm one of those, so I'm putting myself in this camp, but I'm sure you've noticed this, but the people who do these podcasts, when they do company interviews, the audience for those is a fraction of when you interview someone like, you know, yourself or other people who are talking about macro issues. I'm just using you as an example. I'm not saying you riff about macro all the time, right. But it's so interesting. I've heard other people say, oh, the YouTube algorithm, they hate those interviews. But like I've thought that the wisdom that I've gained from interviewing you several times is, you know, people should probably spend a little bit more time listening to those company interviews than all these macro interviews on YouTube where, and again, I don't want to boil everyone and down to the same common denominator, but it's, you know, the summary of all these interviews is we have to print money. Gold's going up. Silver's going to go up. You know, we're going to have hard times coming.
Well, but let's assume that might be true. How many times do you have to hear it?
Right. I mean, stop already. Yeah. You know, I've been, as an example, and you talked about experience at the top of the interview. I've been putting on my investment symposium now for almost 30 years. And the single most liked function at my symposium is the Living Legends. It's taken me 30 years to do it, but I have caused investors to understand. By the way, the Living Legends is always a panel where I introduce three or four entrepreneurs who have built multi-billion-dollar mining companies from scratch. They talk about the lessons they learned, and they talk about why those lessons made them better investors and how those lessons can make you a better investor. It ends up that the most popular feature of my conference is now bigger than the gurus, bigger than Jim Rickards, bigger than Daniela DiMartino Booth, bigger than Nomi Prinz, all of whom are wonderful draws and wonderful contributors. In investor polls, the single most popular part of my conferences is now the Living Legends, where the people who have built multi-billion dollar mining companies from scratch talk about what's important. Too many of the podcast hosts talk to managers who have paid them to present on their channel. And very often, those people who are people who can contribute a $1,000 advertising fee, but have no knowledge to impart. So to the extent that the podcast hosts are interviewing the lame, the halt, and the blind, the median management team of a junior mining company, of course the audience pays less attention. If the interviews involve the Lundins or Ross Beaty or Bob Quartermain or Robert Friedland or Frank Giustra or Craig Perry, perhaps over time the perception of the audience changes. It's something that I'm working very hard to cause to occur. Because I think more knowledge is imparted by the entrepreneurs than by the big thinkers.
Right. Now, let's get into the micro as far as picking companies and researching companies.
Let's do it.
And I apologize if I may have asked you this when we did our last interview, I don't know, 4 or 5 months ago, but it's really interesting to me how, I mean, market timing in natural resource investing is obviously very important, but you come at that from strictly a value standpoint. Can you explain to our listeners how, I mean, yes, they could look at a chart and see when something's oversold or really overbought, but can you explain to them how, at least you personally, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you know, buying real value, that's a form of market timing. And that can be, I mean, that is probably way more effective than trying to time by just looking at a stock chart.
Yeah. I think the screening indicator is whether or not something's unpopular. Perversely, if something's unpopular, it's most often cheap. That means that your brain has to overwhelm your heart. Your heart wants the gratification of a narrative which is established by rising prices, but rising prices by definition means something's no longer cheap. You begin by understanding that extractive industries are extremely capital intensive and extremely cyclical. And you have to buy something that's out of favor. Buffett says, buy low, sell high, buy straw hats in winter. What that means is that in 2021, 2022, when the uranium sector is dead and everybody hates it, when there's no reason to own uranium because it's so cheap, that you have to buy it. You're supposed to buy stuff that's cheap. Conversely, when the uranium prices run from $20 to $100 in 2024, when the rising prices justified the narrative, everybody wants to own uranium when it doesn't have to go up anymore. So the first part of market timing, from my point of view, is to learn to love hate. Buy what's out of favor. Buy what's trounced. Buy what has momentum. Buy the stuff that when you talk about it on social media, you are bombarded by hate mail in the comment section. There is nothing that is as good a determinant that you're right as being unpopular. And mercifully for me, I've spent 5 decades being unpopular and getting rich. I think that's really important. I think it's important to understand something about the fundamentals of your industry. Why was I able to buy uranium stocks in 2022 when nobody else was willing to? It wasn't enough just to be hated. I had to understand the reasons why they would go up. So let's explore that for a minute. It costs the industry, on average, including the cost of capital, about $60 a pound to make uranium in 2022. Not the AISC cost, but the total cost, including taxes and the cost of capital. So you make the stuff for $60 and you sell it for $20. You lose $40 a pound. And being dumb miners, you try and make it up on volume, right? Now that means that either the price of uranium goes back to the cost of producing it, including the cost of capital, or the material is no longer available to society. Then you need to think, well, what would happen if the material became no longer available? Well, in the case of uranium, it meant that the lights would go out. So then the investment equation is very simple. Either the price of uranium goes up to $60, which is to say triples at least, or the lights go out. Which is most likely to occur? I would suggest that's door A. This isn't hard stuff, but most people don't do the work. How do you do the work? Well, there are outfits like the nuclear agencies that publish, as does Urenco, the total cost to produce a pound of uranium. But the rest is common sense. The rest is simply common sense. People react against uranium, A, because it hadn't gone up in price, or in fact had gone down in price from $85 all the way to $10, but B, because it was the stuff of Hiroshima, Nagasaki, Three Mile Island, Chernobyl, and that netted energy physicist Greta Thunberg, of course, didn't like it. But you need to look beyond the rhetoric. You need to look to the fact that even in a country that allegedly is too rich to need uranium, like the United States, that it provides 14% of total power and 20% of baseload power. You learn that a 3% margin between supply and demand on the national electric grid brings a blackout. So what would happen if 13% or 14% disappeared? It couldn't happen. If it couldn't happen, the price of uranium had to go up. This is simple stuff. But most people don't do it. Most people need the psychological reinforcement of price movement to justify the narrative. The problem with waiting is that the value is gone. When the price of uranium goes from 20 to 100, it's easy in the rearview mirror to understand the narrative, but there's not as much point in understanding the narrative as there was before the narrative expressed itself in price action.
Okay. You answered my follow-up, which is why, even though you were saying these things back then in 2022, probably exactly almost, why then do investors, why do they need to see higher prices to get in or feel better about that investment? But I mean, I think I answered that, but if you want to add
partly around the popularity of podcasts. If you had had a podcast with the uranium headline in 2022, the perverse incentive would be that while your opinion would be highly valuable, nobody would give a damn. Now, if you do a uranium podcast, now that the price has gone from $20 to $100 and the information is of less value, you'd get 50,000 viewers. So the truth is that part of the industry of distributing information is based around absorption. And the point in time when your message has the most value is that point in time when it's desired the least. As a
Okay, now.
podcast host, your challenge is to popularize the Daily Gold enough that you can deliver unpopular messages that will be profitable. And that's a challenge.
Yes, it is. All right, now let's move on to something that's near and dear to both of our hearts, gold and silver juniors.
Love it.
Rick, can you think of another time in your career when you had, gold breaking out and trending? I mean, it might be a little early to say that, but I mean, you have this gold price, but the juniors in the stocks relative to gold are so, hated and cheap. I mean, is there another time that reminds you of, or are we in a like a new? Okay, yes.
Twice before, it's really bullish. 1970, late 1975, early 1976, the Federal Reserve had doubled the interest rate. The gold price crashed from $200 to $100, but they never dealt with the underlying inflation. When the Fed lost their nerve in 1976, people hated gold stocks because they'd lost so much money on them in 1995. I mean, they hated them. The hate was palpable. And the people who got shaken out in 1975 at $100 gold missed a 6-year run in gold from $100 to $850, and the damnedest bull market in junior stocks I ever saw. But in 1976, you could fire a cannon through the Vancouver Stock Exchange and not hurt anybody. Nobody cared. Fast forward, gold started moving in 2000. It wasn't until 2002 that there were glimmers of hope in the junior mining stock market. My 1998 partnership, if my memory serves me well, generated something like a 55% compound internal rate of return in the period between 1998 and 2008. My 2000 partnership, which had 2 years less of the bad times, if memory serves me well, generated a 69% compound internal rate of return after fees. The fact that nobody cared about the mining stocks in the period 2000 to 2002, when gold was already on the move, enabled me to position myself ahead of the interest in the junior sectors. Now, will that occur in 2024? I don't know. How about 2025? I don't know. I don't know when. But I believe that we're in a circumstance that's historically analogous to 1975, 76. And to 2000 to 2002. I'm a gold bull. So people need to refresh their premise around gold and around why gold might move and around where gold might move to. But somebody needs to look too at history, and this is where some aspects of charts are useful, to see the price appreciation, not just of the best gold juniors, but rather of things like what used to be called the VSE Resource Index or the TSX Junior Resource Index, and look at the truly insane amounts of money that were made by being 2 or 3 years early. If you are late in a market that doubles, you have missed the easy money. The way that you make that easy money, and I don't mean psychologically easy, I just mean less risky money. The way that you make that easy money is that you have to be early.
Rick, in our last interview, you mentioned that gold, I think, was tolerated, silver hated. Have we seen any changes? I mean, hated,
No,
tolerated, or
not at
loved, that's what
all.
you say. So not at all.
Not at all. And I misunderstood a little bit about the character of the gold market, the current gold market at that point in time. Because the community that I hang out in is gold-centric, and because virtually all of the old friends of gold are involved in concerted buying campaigns, all of us are adding physical gold. I assumed that the retail market was adding physical gold. Meanwhile, the physical gold ETFs are experiencing disintermediation, which is to say that private investors in the West are selling gold. The gold price is moving up
only on central bank buying. If I am right that the psyche of the retail investor resembles the psyche of the retail investor in the period 1967 to 1972, I think that the real buying in the gold sector will occur when the retail investor understands the perniciousness of the decline in their purchasing power relative to conventional fiat-denominated savings instruments. And when you have central bank buying underlying retail buying, then you will see a move in the gold price. And the move in the gold price won't be a move from $2,000 to $2,150 or from $2,100 to $2,200. That's not why I own gold. I don't buy it for the probability of okay increases. I buy it because of the possibility that we see a replay of the decade 2000 to 2010, where the gold price went up sevenfold. I'm not saying it's going to happen, but I wouldn't be surprised at all, Jordan. I'm not saying it's going to happen, but I wouldn't be surprised at all to see $7,000 gold or $8,000 gold. So I would begin by saying I misspoke with the sense that gold was tolerated. It's only barely tolerated. And silver is still hated. Silver speculators need to understand that prior bull markets have been led by gold. They've been led by the fear buyer. Market momentum and the market narrative has to be established by gold. But when the generalist money comes to understand the narrative, too late for them to participate in the gold trade, maybe, the lower unit cost of silver and the increased volatility of silver means that silver moves further and much faster than gold. But gold needs to establish the momentum. I am buying the silver stocks now. I have a psychological aberration. When they're up off the bottom, I'm too cheap to buy them. So I have to buy them at the bottom or even on the way down. Or else, because I'm a pathological cheapskate, I won't participate. There are probably younger people who could rely on something like technical analysis to understand something about the early stages of momentum. I'm not that smart, and I'm not willing to pay up, so I need to buy now.
Yeah, I want to get more into silver stocks, but one question I had for you, and maybe you answered this at your boot camp. When you're evaluating gold juniors versus silver juniors, are there any distinctions? I mean, granted, companies you're looking at size and management and all those things, and the quality of the asset. Are there
gold is a more forgiving business. More forgiving because the price of silver isn't dependent on silver mines. Only about 17% of the primary production of silver comes from silver mines. The rest comes from recycling, or it comes from byproduct production from base metals mines. So to understand the supply of silver 5 years from now, you need to have an opinion about how much gold is mined and about how much copper is mined and about how much lead is mined and about how much zinc is mined. And it's damned hard. In fact, I've never got it right, ever. So it's much less forgiving. It's also much less volatile, which is to say it's much more rewarding if you have the courage to do it. The gold business is a little bit more sensible. Now, it's true on the supply side that almost all the gold that's ever been mined is still supply. We do something perversely stupid. We take it out of a hole in the ground called a mine, and we put it in a hole in the ground called a vault. So that's difficult too, but it's still a more forgiving business. What's important for investors to understand is that the gold mining business is much bigger. So you have a much greater population to select from, and it's more forgiving. It is an easier business than the silver business.
Just a quick rapid fire one for you. What is the best silver stock investment that you ever made, or the most profitable?
The most profitable silver stock investment that I ever made, and this is outrageous, so don't count this as indicative, was underwriting Pan American Silver and Ross Beaty at 50 cents with a full warrant at 75 cents. In 6 years, that stock was something like $45 bid. Having a dollar and a half warrant in a $4 bid market is as much fun as you can have with your clothes on. There's just nothing like it. That's the most outrageous example. Before I was able to invest, before I had any money to invest, and I didn't know how to do it, in the period 1971 to 1981, if my memory serves me well, Coeur d'Alene Mines went from a dime on the Spokane Exchange to $65 on the New York Stock Exchange. Sadly, it did that without Rick Rule. But Pan American, I was front and center. The second best was probably Silver Standard, which went from a 72-cent underwriting with a buck and a quarter warrant, again, to $45 bid in 6 years. Life-changing experiences.
Wow. And a lot of fun.
That
with
too.
Your clothes on. Yeah,
wonderful people. The amount of enjoyment I've gotten out of my friendship with Ross Beaty and Bob Quartermain was actually probably ultimately more gratifying than the money I made. So, yes.
Yeah, I'm sure the money helped a little bit, too.
It did. It absolutely did. You wouldn't be listening to me otherwise, Jordan. I'd be talking into an empty screen.
Oh, no, I'd still be here asking you questions. Let's talk about developers, because in our last interview, I think you mentioned that they were the cheapest that you had ever seen. Is that true?
Yep.
When you're looking at developers, I guess I'm listing all the criteria, but to you, what are the most important things when you're looking at developer? I know they can get this from your boot camp, but just humor our audience for a couple minutes. Is it optionality? Is it margin? I mean, is it size?
Your estimate or the feasibility studies estimate of net present value relative to the enterprise value of the company, the delta between what it's worth or what it's probably worth and what it's selling for, as a factor of the probability of them obtaining their goals and the amount of time it takes, which is to say the net present value of the opportunity relative to the cost of buying that opportunity. Many investors seem to have trauma holding stock over a long weekend. And the development process from, say, pre-feasibility through nameplate capacity is often 5 years or 6 years. And many investors can't conceive of holding an investment for 5 years or 6 years, which means that most investors never make money, because money is made by answering unanswered questions, adding value, and compounding takes time. The development cycle has been described in the gold mining industry by Pierre Lassonde as the dead period, the quiet period. And for whatever reason, investors seem to need vicarious stimulation as opposed to the probability of making money. The press releases might include such scintillating topics as the preliminary engineering studies are 85% complete, or primary construction work is 50% complete. Stuff that's pathologically boring, but stuff that's really, really, really important in understanding the probability of on-time completion relative to net present value. Investors who are willing to do the work will find that period to be data rich, and they will also find the markets to be competition poor. How do you get a better combination of that than that?
How is the value? So if developers are the cheapest of everything, then how would you, what would you say is the relative value then of junior producers and then junior explorers, which I know you really love?
Well, I like junior explorers because they're even riskier and more hated than developers. And there's nothing I like quite as much as hate. You will have a period after the market has experienced seven or eight discoveries where the anticipation of success in exploration juniors is way, way, way too high. And good investors have to get out of the market then. If you have too much competition and the competition is stupid, there's just absolutely no margin in competing with dumb money. But right now, even the smart money isn't an exploration. I love markets where there's no competition. I love explorer. I love a circumstance where explorers have really good people, and they have two or three projects that I like a lot, and they're selling at or a discount to cash, which is to say I get the people and I get the assets for free. And there are probably 30 of those companies on the TSXV now. I actually get paid to buy the company. They're selling at a discount to cash, and I get the assets for free. I love this. I just love this. Now, you need to understand that 95% of the exploration companies are valueless. And if you don't have the education or you aren't willing to do the work to segregate in movie parlance between the good, the bad, and the ugly, then you don't belong in the space. But if you want to put yourself in the way of 10 baggers or 15 baggers, you have to be in that space. You absolutely have to be in that space. It's very difficult to get a 15 bagger out of a $3 billion company. It is not that difficult, if you're skilled, to get a 15 bagger out of a $5 million company. And if you get a $5 million company that has good people, good projects, and $6 million in cash, which is to say that its enterprise value is negative $1 million, you stand a much better chance of seeing that market cap go to $75 million than if you buy a company with a $5 million enterprise value with lousy people, no projects, and no cash. This is just simple stuff, but most people don't do it, mercifully for me.
So, Rick, I want to follow up on what you said earlier. You said you're buying silver stocks now. Are you buying producers, developers, explorers? Can you give us a few more details?
Yeah, yes, yes, and yes. At every sign of weakness, I buy a little bit of Wheaton Precious, which is to say I think the highest quality silver company in the world, despite the fact that its earnings are now gold dominant. It still enjoys a prominent silver franchise, and to the extent that silver goes up, it benefits disproportionately from its silver streams. I buy Pan American because it's so roundly hated. Nothing I like more than hate. And I buy it because they have 500 million high-grade ounces that they aren't able to produce in Guatemala and a separate 500 million high-grade ounces that they aren't able to produce in Argentina. If they come to be able to produce either of those, neither of them are factored into the market cap. So I get 1 billion ounces of high-grade prospective production for free. Meanwhile, I get a company that diluted, if you will, its existing shareholders by half when they bought the Yamana assets. It's only dilutive, of course, if the assets that you bought are less valuable than the assets that you already had. Irrespective, what Silver Standard, what Pan American has done is, first of all, increase the size and scope of the company and the liquidity, which always helps. But they are also in the process of selling off the Tier 2 assets, rebuilding their balance sheet, and being able to focus on a smaller number of higher quality assets. So I own Pan American for reasons that are unique, I think, to Pan American, but include silver. Coming down the quality scale, I think that MAG is selling at a fair price. Not a great price, a fair price. And I love buying great companies for fair prices. I see that as a superb ore body. And I see the company selling effectively at net present value. I see upside from exploration, and I see upside from the silver price. So I'm attracted to what I see as a great deposit for a fair price. I'm studying Silvercrest, which I sold because they disappointed me when the reserves that they were able to cite at mine completion were so much less than they were in the feasibility study. What I like about Silvercrest is that the deposit is now working. I look at cash at beginning of period, cash at end of period, debt at beginning of period, debt at end of period. And I see that despite whatever financial trickery or accounting trickery they might be, they're generating a ton of cash. And I like companies generating a ton of cash. I'm not going to buy it until I see their new reserve statement. I want to see that the money that they've spent in delineation drilling has been successful. And I want to understand something about the net present value of the ore body. But I'm looking at it positively inclined. And then I'm, of course, buying advanced explorers and producers, the Aya Silvers, which are, I think, fairly priced, but I think have a lot of exploration production upside. The Abra Silvers, which I think are stupidly cheap relative to the resource base, albeit have to answer some unanswered questions. Vizsla Silver, which I see as cheap relative to the resource base, but again, they have to answer some unanswered questions. I know with regards to myself that I have to buy in anticipation of these answers, and I have to buy in anticipation of the silver market returning to favor, because if these things double, which they easily could, I'll be so angry that I missed the double that I won't be in line to make the five bagger that comes after the double. So I need to buy these guys when nobody else is buying them, when they hate them. And I love the fact that the silver stock is so out of favor that Abra can release 10 drill holes, good drill holes, or Vizsla can produce 10 drill holes, or they can produce MET studies that are positive, and the stocks sell off. The information gets better and the share prices go down. That means that I have time to incorporate this new information in my models, that I have time to learn more, that I have time to be more certain. And I don't pay any penalty for not buying the stock. This is just as good as it gets for a value guy like me.
Okay, Rick. Great information. Have to leave it there. But before I let you go, please tell us, I know you have a couple events coming up. You have the Prospect Generator Bootcamp. That's coming on April 20th. You also have the Rural Symposium in July. Why don't you talk about those? So the Prospect Generator Bootcamp first.
I have two things to give away and two things to sell. If you like what I have to say about natural resource stocks, make it personal. Go to ruralinvestmentmedia.com, list your natural resource stocks, and for no obligation, absolutely for free, I'll rank them 1 to 10, 1 being best, 10 being worst. Then go to Rural Classroom. There's 200 hours of instructional programming there on how to become a better investor. Invest in yourself before you invest your treasure in these markets. It's absolutely free. There's 200 hours of it. By the way, there's a weekly question and answer there done by me personally. I'll sit in and do questions and answers. So go there. It's absolutely free. If you're going to invest money, learn about the subject. Go to the boot camps. These are 8-hour long sessions, really, really intensive, really, really, really deep, not entertainment, information. You'll have access to the tapes for a year, and you'll need it because we'll give you more information in 8 hours than you can absorb in 8 hours. We're doing prospect generation and exploration as the next one because people hate it so much. We love sectors out of favor because those are the profitable sectors. $99 to attend. It's virtual, so you attend it in the comfort of your own home. Gold-plated money-back guarantee. If you don't believe that you got $99 worth out of attending, email me. I'll give you your $99 back. But the best thing I do is the Rural Symposium. This year is in Boca Raton, Florida. We've done it for about 30 years. This is simply, I think, the best natural resources investment symposium on the planet. Attend in person if you can, 4 days, July 7 to 11 in Boca Raton, California. If you can't, join the 1,300 people last year who attended in the live stream, which you can do in the comfort of your own home. Great big picture thinkers, the Daniela DiMartino Booths, the Jim Rickards, the Bill Bonners, the Grant Williams of the world, telling you about the way the world really is, not the way that the big thinkers, the Bidens and the Trudeaus, wish it were. Beyond that, natural resource analysts and portfolio managers who've made money in resources for 30 years, not some failed hack at an investment bank that failed in technology analysis or failed in supermarket or auto analysis, but people who've made money where the rubber meets the road in natural resources. The aforementioned living legends, people who have built multi-billion dollar mining companies from scratch, the Robert Friedlands of the world, telling you about their successes and failures and how the lessons that they learned will make you a better investor. And then, of course, a group of exhibitors that are invited. At most conferences, the qualification to be an exhibitor is a check that cashes. At our conference, a public company exhibitor has to be owned in accounts owned and managed by me. It doesn't mean that every stock I buy goes up, but it does mean that I vetted those damned exhibitors. If I don't think they're worth my money, I don't think they're worth your money. So every exhibitor at our conference is vetted. And once again, whether you attend live, which I encourage, or via live stream, If you don't believe that you got your money's worth, email me. Absolute gold-plated money-back guarantee.
And Rick, one more thing. I think you have a third thing to sell, Battle Bank. We could see the right
Absolutely.
There on your shirt. I think you forgot about that. So tell our listeners about Battle Bank.
If any of your listeners are unhappy with their current bank, which I suspect means all of your listeners, check out Battle Bank. We believe that we should pay you a fair interest on your deposits, not have deposit products that pay you no interest. We believe that we should pay you interest on your checking account. Most bankers don't believe that. We believe, like we believe at EverBank, our last bank, that you might not want to deposit money just in U.S. dollars, that you might want to earn interest on euros or Canadian dollars or Australian dollars. We will offer CDs in 22 currencies. We believe that your IRA is your IRA, not a receptacle for other people's financial deposits. With us, your IRA can own an LLC, which can itself buy a franchise, operate a business, own a duplex, own a triplex, own a fourplex, all of which is legal. The big thinkers don't want you to know this because they want you to buy their junky mutual funds. We believe that your IRA is your IRA. Finally, if you're a gold holder, if you own physical gold and bullion, first of all, thank you for your intelligence. But secondly, if you want to continue to own it, but you need to access liquidity, which is to say you need to borrow against it to buy a summer home, to buy more gold, whatever. We believe that your gold is good collateral. If you hold gold in a segregated account, we will establish a credit facility against your gold, so that you can access the liquidity in your gold or silver without having to sell it. If you think that a bank that loans against good collateral like gold or silver is better than a bank that speculates in derivatives, consider Battle Bank. If you like a bank that thinks that your IRA is your IRA rather than a receptacle for their products, think about Battle Bank. If you think that a bank should pay you interest on your deposits or that you ought to be able to determine for yourself which currencies you'd like to save in, think Battle Bank. Go to battlebank.com, or when you go to Rural Investment Media and rank your natural resource portfolios, in the question and comment section, simply write in bank.
Okay, so ruleinvestmentmedia.com, that's where they should go first.
Right, absolutely. And rank your natural resource stock portfolios. Absolutely free, and I think highly valuable.
Okay. On that note, Rick, I mean, we could go all day, but I know you're a busy man. Thanks so much for coming on. I and my listeners, we really appreciate it. And hopefully we can do this again in the coming months.
Always a pleasure. Hopefully I see you down in Boca Raton, the finest natural resource investment conference on the planet.
Thank you for tuning into the Daily Gold Podcast. For more interviews, editorials, and analysis, log on to thedailygold.com. And for premium coverage of precious metals and the best junior mining companies, visit thedailygold.com/premium.